Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast episode 79 for December 7th, 2010. I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm David Liu.
And I'm David O'Brien.
We have three stories for you this week, almost four, depending on how you count it. First off, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court and them granting review in one case and denying review in another case. Next, we're going to talk about the federal prosecutors ditching the Xbox prosecution over somebody who modded his Xbox and many other people's Xbox for money, allegedly. And lastly, we're going to talk about this Level 3 net neutrality dispute that they have going on with Comcast that involves Netflix and peering arrangements, but we'll all get to that in due course. First off, we're going to talk about the Supreme Court granting certiorari in a case involving Microsoft and the presumption of validity of patents. And as a corollary to that, that Microsoft denied certiorari or denied review in the Harper case. So I actually kind of want to start with the Harper case. Briefly, this is a case where a young cheerleader had downloaded some music off of some file sharing service. I don't remember whether it was Napster or Nutella. And her argument at trial was, I should be able to say that I'm an innocent infringer and get a lower amount of statutory damages because I did not know that this was illegal at the time. And she's basing this on the fact, principally two things. First of all, that she was very young, and second, that the digital files did not have any copyright notice on them. The recording industry didn't agree. So, David O'Brien, could you summarize the recording industry's argument briefly as to why they thought that she shouldn't be eligible to be an innocent infringer or to raise that defense?
Yes. So their argument was all based on the fact that on the printed CDs, as they came out, there is actually a notice of copyright registration on them. And there's some interesting arguments as to whether the innocent infringer limitation of the statutory damages actually applies when there is a notice by way of like a printed copyright registration on the face of a CD or something like that. So we're kind of talking about the little C with a circle on it, which provide a notice that a work has actually been registered to the Copyright Office. So their argument was is that because the CDs, as they appeared, or the records as they were being sold in the store, had a notice physically printed on them on the front of them, she should have had a notice, even though she was downloading the works online rather than buying them in the store or copying them from actual CDs, where she would have seen the notice of the copyright registration.
Right. And the appeals court, so first Ms. Harper appealed to one of the circuit courts of appeals. I don't remember which one off the top of my head. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Thank you, Dominic. And the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals did not agree with Ms. Harper. So she asked the Supreme Court to take the case. And the Supreme Court typically does not take cases where there is not a circuit split. And we've talked about this before, but there are a whole bunch of different circuit courts of appeals. And if they disagree on the legal result in two similar cases, the Supreme Court will often grant review of one of those cases to kind of say, okay, well, we've got to decide one way or the other, otherwise we're going to have inconsistent law across the land. So, because there is no circuit split, and in fact, I think this may be like the second or third time that this innocent infringer provision has really ever come up for review. It's pretty rarely used. Because there was no circuit split, the Supreme Court denied cert. But the interesting thing, and I guess why we're talking about it, was that there was a dissent from the denial of certiorari. Justice Alito, who's one of the newer justices on the court, essentially said he took a look at it, and his reasoning was, it's unlikely that we're ever going to get a case like this. It raises some interesting issues about whether or not this particular provision of the copyright really applies to digital files, and I think it's worth taking a look at. But his dissent did not carry the day, and the Supreme Court declined to hear the case.
Just out of curiosity, are there other areas of law where innocent infringer statutes can be used?
Potentially. I don't know that we could call any of them out specifically for you. It's definitely interesting that we have a statutory damages provision here, which has a specific component to it, which says if you have a case where an infringer reasonably believed that what she or he was doing was not actually infringement, then it reduces the damages from that the threshold, like in a willful case where you have the spectrum of $750 to $150,000, it reduces it down to a sum of not less than $200 per work infringed. And it's sort of odd because it doesn't seem like this particular limitation has very many teeth in it, which is I think why it gets a lot of attention in the media. And when you combine that with this other strange limitation about the notice of copyright registration in a distributed work being printed on it and that having the effect of sort of removing this innocent infringer provision, it seems to be almost wholly irrelevant in a world where we now have digital downloads and you can have an instance like this, like a 13 or 14-year-old girl who believes what she was doing was the same thing as listening to the radio on the internet, or so she says.
Right. The other interesting thing about this, and I think why it's unique and why we don't see it a lot, is first you need for an innocent infringer law or to that for that to take place outside of, you know, just arguing to the jury that the person didn't really know what they were doing and hope the jury either gives them a break or doesn't find them liable in the first place, is that you need, in this case, something like a strict liability where it doesn't really matter whether or not you intended to do it. It's that you actually did it. And then you need, typically, you need some sort of statutory damages scheme and then, you know, this innocent infringer provision, which allows you to lower the statutory damages. And having strict liability, and it's just not that common. It's not that common in criminal law. It's not that common in civil law. You usually are seeking to punish people who had the intent to do something, not the people who did it accidentally or did it not knowing that it was illegal or bad. Any last thoughts on this before we move to the Microsoft case?
I do. Yeah, so there is sort of the provision, the innocent infringer provision in case is sort of, as David mentioned, sort of a relic of an older time, because it used to, like, there's a provision in there that says that if you on the phono record, there's copyrighted, this, like, this phono record is copyright, an artist or a music label, then that precludes an innocent infringer defense. And what the record companies were basically arguing was that that because the CDs that the songs had been ripped from had that notice, then this cheerleader, Miss Harper, necessarily also somehow had the notice, even though she didn't ever see those CDs because she was 16. She logged on, didn't realize how file sharing worked, just started downloading files, not realizing that she was infringing copyright, because how was she to know, honestly?
Yeah, I think their argument was also that they were theoretically available to her. She could have walked into any record store, flipped the CD over, and seen the copyright notice, which is, it's a little ridiculous, frankly.
It's true. But, I mean, she might not even have a concept of what a CD is anymore, because, I mean, who uses them anymore, right?
Yeah, as a side note, I was visiting last weekend with, I guess, a cousin-in-law of mine who's in college now, and she mentioned to me that she had never paid for music in her life, despite having a rather extensive music collection, which kind of bowled me over. The thing that I saw her doing was going on YouTube, playing the song, using her computer to capture the audio stream from her web browser, and then saving the MP3 that created, which I thought was a kind of novel way, although there are websites that you can just punch in a YouTube URL and it will make an MP3 for you.
Yeah. She was actually feedbacking the audio?
Yeah. Yep.
That's a lossy compression, or that's a lossy capture method.
I'll let her know. I'm sure she's really concerned with that.
Okay.
Okay, back to the Microsoft case. So, in a nutshell, this was a case about, I believe, the patent that Microsoft allegedly infringed, well, they were found to infringe it, related to the storing of XML content in their new versions of Office apps. And Microsoft was found to have infringed this, given a $290 million judgment, which in light of some recent patent and copyright verdicts is, you know, but a drop in the bucket. Microsoft appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Their argument on appeal there was, and this is, I found this really interesting, Microsoft essentially argued that the standard for proving a patent to be invalid is too high. That typically in civil cases, you're asked to prove something by preponderance of the evidence, that it's more likely than not that, you know, somebody trespassed on your lawn or that you infringe a patent. To find a patent invalid, you have to provide clear and convincing evidence, which is somewhere between more probable than not, but less than beyond a reasonable doubt. And Microsoft's argument, Microsoft's argument before the Supreme Court is essentially going to be, well, listen, the U.S. Patent Office is overworked. Patents get flipped all the time. Perhaps we're putting too high a value on the work that the Patent Office does, and perhaps we should be proving that patents are invalid by preponderance of the evidence as opposed to by clear and convincing evidence. And the reason I found this interesting is because there, without a question like this, without an interesting kind of statutory far-reaching question, it was unlikely that they would have gotten Supreme Court review of what's otherwise a fairly normal patent case. And I think that there's some very clever litigator who Microsoft hired to kind of put this seed of a certiorari case, something that the Supreme Court will want to hear. You know, get that in there at the trial level, exploit it on appeal, and then have something that the Supreme Court will want to decide so that Microsoft can basically get review of the whole case in the Supreme Court, whereas if they didn't have this, the Supreme Court probably wouldn't have taken the case. So comments on Microsoft's tactics or the likelihood of their success, saying that does anyone have any thoughts on this, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. I'll open it up to the floor.
Well, changing the standard of review is kind of a big deal, or maybe not.
I mean, but is it the rate that we flip the U.S. Patent Office anyway? I mean, I don't have firm numbers, but it seems like it's not unusual to find a patent invalid for one reason or another.
It's expensive, sure. Though. I think it's an expensive endeavor under the current standards because they're much higher than Microsoft would like to see them. It's an expensive proposition to go into court and try to invalidate somebody's patent when you might, you know, find other ways to settle or just license the technology or the invention that underlies the patent itself. And if this is changed, we actually might see more cases go to court or more people be willing to try to invalidate patents.
You right. really think that it'll be less expensive to invalidate a patent under a more probable than not or by preponderance of the evidence rather than by clear and convincing? Well,
no, it's just an expensive proposition to go to court in general. It's not so much that it costs more in one case versus another. It's just you have this barrier that, okay, you're being accused of, you know, violating this invention here. They haven't sued yet, but they are threatening to sue. Do you want to fight this now? Do you want to file suit for or, you know, do you want to try to settle this outside of litigation? And you have lawyer's expenses and et cetera.
Ben, okay, do you want to give us a rundown of the various like levels of standards of review, I guess.
I mean, I tried to do that earlier. That there's by preponderance of the evidence, which is, I hate to put numbers on this, but it's like 51%. I have to prove, if I want to win, I have to make my case just slightly more convincing than your case that it's not. There's clear and convincing evidence, which most people put around 75%, that it's really likely, but not an absolute lock. And then there's beyond a reasonable doubt, which most people peg between 90 and 99%, that, you know, the full weight of the evidence goes there, and you don't really have any doubts in your mind. We really only see beyond a reasonable doubt in criminal cases, and we see clear and convincing in civil matters, where there's a strong reason to weigh it in favor of one side or the other. And the idea up until now was that we want to give the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office the benefit of the doubt that they're correct and say that you have, in order to invalidate the patent, you have to prove by clear and convincing evidence, by this relatively high bar, that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office got it wrong and should not have granted the patent.
So, but wouldn't changing the level make patents more or less valuable?
Did you say more or less valuable or more
or
less?
He did say that. I was going to let that slide. Oh, okay.
More or less valuable.
My guess is it would make them less valuable because it would reduce the it would reduce the likelihood of them being upheld on in a trial or as David suggests it would increase the likelihood of them being challenged in trial as opposed to people settling early. That being said, I don't think that's a consideration that will get people to write, you know, amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, but I don't think it's something that the Supreme Court's likely to take with much weight. I don't think Supreme Court is concerned with the value of the patent. They're concerned with, you know, whether or not that's the proper standard of review, given the stresses on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office to process as many patents as they do.
Maybe you could help me a little bit, because I didn't really have a chance to read any of the appeals that went through in detail. So is the argument that there's less of a standard, or there's a lower standard for other types of civil cases, and because of that, you know, it should work by analogy that the same standard should apply in patent cases?
From what I understand, it's essentially that we've been applying this clear and convincing standard that's higher than the standard that we apply everywhere else, and there's no good reason to apply that clear and convincing standard given how often the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office gets it wrong, so we should lower that standard.
Okay, so it's more about policy than an actual, like, strong differences between standards that are given to other types of cases or other types of evidence.
Yes, from at least to the extent that I understand and can parrot their argument back.
We should probably point out, too, I don't know if you already did this, but the patents have a presumption of validity when you take them to court, and that's a burden then that the party who's trying to invalidate the patent has to overcome.
Right, yeah. To plead successfully that you have a valid patent, you merely need to say, I have a patent certificate that says I have a patent. And you've proved that part of your case, unless the other party can prove otherwise. Any last thoughts on this, David Liu?
I think I'm all set.
David O'Brien.
Just really quick, I mean, we've seen a lot of action this year with the Bilski case, for instance, and a few others that deal with, actually the last 3 years, that deal with various standards like injunctions and, you know, what the standards are for patentable subject matter. And all of those have gone up to the Supreme Court, at least in those two big cases that I'm thinking of. So, you know, it seems kind of clear that we're probably going to see some movement sooner or later in Congress to change the standards, whatever needs to be done, that law clearly needs to be updated to some extent, because it just seems to signal big problems to me.
Yes, I'm going to go ahead and assume that you meant injunctions and not conjunctions there.
Yes.
Okay, and before I throw it to Dominic for his last thoughts, I do want to chime in and say that I'm pretty sure this case will be heard this term. So, I mean, I'm not 100% sure. My guess is we will have argument in this case in the spring and then have a decision by June or July. So, Dominic, any last thoughts?
All set.
Okay, I think O'Brien has the next case. So we'll.
Yes, we can take this right away to the Xbox case. I think if anybody has read any articles this week on Gizmodo, Wired, Ars Technica, or any of the major tech news sites, they probably saw something about the Xbox modding trial. And this is the first case since the enactment of the DMCA, at least that I'm aware of, and I think this is what's being reported too, since 1998, when this particular provision of the Copyright Act was actually enacted, that deals with the criminal provisions under the anti-circumvention section of the DMCA. This student at the time, I believe, or actually he was a working for a hotel parking garage. His name was Matthew Crippen, a young man from Southern California who was modifying the firmware on the optical drives for Xbox 360s. More specifically, that meant that you could basically run games that had been pirated or that had otherwise made their way on in some sort of unsigned or unverified way onto an optical disc and put them onto the machine. And the U.S. attorneys decided to dismiss the case this week, I believe just on the second day of trial. A trial started Tuesday, and they had a number of problems from the get-go. First story that came out that was reported by Wired, they had some people who were actually at the trial. During the opening statements, the judge in the case just went off on the prosecutors for reportedly 30 minutes. It was a 30-minute long bench slap about various problems with witnesses and how he had major concerns about the case and the merits of the case ultimately. And one of the big problems he had to do with the mens rea standard that is in the statute itself, and there was also some question as to what the U.S. attorney's standards are in their own manual. So we'll talk about some of these things. It's all pretty interesting. This is a kind of a wild story. So did I leave out any of the major facts?
I think what the definition of a bench slap is.
Yes. That, I mean, I don't know that there's any other way to put it. It was just a verbal lashing by the judge. So we can start, I guess, with the anti-circumvention provisions in the DMCA, Section 1201, which prohibits circumventing access controls or copy protection controls on copyrighted works. And so this case deals with a defendant who is modifying the firmware on the optical drive of the Xboxes, and that particular little bit of software actually controls the access of any optical media to the rest of the hardware. He was modifying those specifically. So just off the start, even though that this case was dismissed, this does not sound like it was very good. And he was operating, or he was doing this as for a business, basically, charging people money, having them come over, doing some modifications to the device himself. This doesn't sound like very good behavior, at least as far as the statutory language in the Act goes. It might have been a different story if he was just doing this for his own uses. There have been some courts which say that, or at least one court that I'm aware of that says if you're just doing this for your personal uses, it might not be a violation on the basis of fair use. But first off, I think the fact that he was doing this as for a commercial activity really hurt him. Even despite all of that, though, there were some questions as to the standards that of the mens rea, which is the sort of knowledge standards, how willful your actions actually had to be. And there are also some evidentiary problems in the case. So, Ben, I know that you followed the case kind of close, and you were pretty familiar with the evidence that the prosecutors tried to introduce. Can you tell us what happened?
Yeah, so I think the thing that eventually led to this the dismissal is that, as you mentioned, there's a mens rea issue here, and that's basically the level of intent that you have to prove that you're guilty of the crime. Most crimes, you basically just need to prove that you intended to do, you know, the end result of the crime. Like, I intended to go into somebody's house that was not my own by, you know, prying open a window and stealing something inside. That would be burglary. Whether or not I actually stole something, as long as I intentionally entered the house with the intent to steal something, that's fine. Well, not fine, that's illegal, but yeah, that, you know, that's the level you have to meet. The problem is if I enter somebody else's house thinking that it's my own, that's not burglary because I didn't intend to enter somebody else's house. With this anti-circumvention law, I guess the trick here is that they had to prove that it was done willfully, and in order to prove that, you have to you basically have to prove that the person knows it's illegal before they do it. And in fact, the only thing off the top of my head that I can think of you also have to do willfully is tax fraud, and that's just because tax laws are so confusing. So essentially what the issue in the case was that they, in the discovery process, early on, the prosecution is supposed to tell the defense all of the evidence that the prosecution intends to bring out during the case. And what they did not have is anyone saying that the defendant knew what he was doing was illegal. What ended up happening at trial, and I think it was on the first days of the actual trial where they were having witnesses testify, was that one of the federal... And a federal undercover agent took the stand and testified to essentially that he saw the kid mod the Xbox and then put a pirated game on the Xbox and then run the pirated game. The problem was that the prosecution had never told the defense that he was going to say that, and as a result, it was considered unfair surprise, and the judge excluded all of that evidence. The judge said, well, we can't have any of that come in because the defense didn't know that he was going to testify to that. And without that evidence... the prosecution essentially didn't have a case anymore. One of the side things they were trying to do was argue that it did not have to be willful, but that's pretty clearly in the statute that it has to be willful. So, you know, the two gambits they have to get this evidence in that pretty much wasn't going to come in, or to argue for a lower standard of intent, the lower mens rea standard. Both of those gambits failed, and the prosecution was pretty much forced to dismiss the case. And that's ignoring all of the other problems that they had.
They also had a couple of problems with witnesses, and this was kind of funny. And not just the witness who testified on the first day, but I think that there were two witnesses, one of which may or may not have been a former Microsoft employee, and another one which I wasn't really sure if he was some sort of just a cooperating witness that, you know, helped out the prosecution, or if he was actually some sort of had involvement with either the FBI or the local authorities, which, you know, did the initial arrest. But I think he had a bit of a shady background. In fact, he had been modifying, as shady as this actually is, I mean, I don't know that it's all that shady, but for legal purposes in a court, might not go over too well if the jury found out that you were modifying Xboxes back when you were in college yourself. And here you are on the stand, part of one of the sides, calling out somebody else for their bad acts.
Yes, and that just goes to a problem with as to the credibility of the witnesses, more than anything else. But it's not great when two of your witnesses take the stand and then immediately admit that they're felons, or, you know, the worst part of it is if the witnesses take the stand and then once, you know, the prosecution is done questioning, if the defense comes up and goes, so, have you committed a felony? And the people have to say yes. Neither of those are particularly good for your case.
Lawyers use that to impeach the credibility, usually to impeach the credibility of the witnesses at trial. So it was kind of clear if the defense wanted to bring that up when those witnesses were on the stand for cross-examination, they would be allowed to introduce that as evidence in the case or as evidence for impeachment. Interestingly, though, I mean, what I thought was most interesting about this case overall is just how botched it was. I mean, it sounds like these were a lot of procedural mistakes that were made. It seemed like very shoddy work. And Matthew Crippen, who's the defendant in the case, he gets to walk away from this, but it actually seemed like they could have had a great case against him. And a lot of the articles that I were reading kind of made a mockery of it, and were sort of, some of them were making a mockery of the law itself. And I thought that the law was pretty clear. I mean, I'm staring at the statutory provision right now, which is, I think, section 1204, which specifies the criminal offenses portion of the anti-circumvention part of the DMCA. I mean, it's a very simple, just a few paragraphs that are put together. It's not like this is a complex statutory reading. It very clearly says willfully and for purposes of commercial advantage or private financial gain, if you violate any provision of the anti-circumvention portion of the DMCA and you do it willfully, you know, you could be held criminally liable in a court of law. What did you guys think about the way that people were reporting this and how the U.S. attorneys handled the case?
The reporting, I think, if you look over the past 2 weeks, has been very interesting. In that last week, the reporting was, "Oh my God, he's gonna go down in flames. All of the defense's gambits are failing." And as soon as the judge started yelling at the prosecution, it turned on a dime as far as how people felt his chances were. And I mean, that's not unusual because federal prosecutors tend to be very good at their job, and they don't tend to botch prosecutions as badly as this, or even very often.
Yeah, it's really surprising to see them basically fail at this point after all this time and money necessarily.
One thing I didn't look at was how large this business was that he was running. I mean, I don't know if this was like a substantial operation or if this was really like he modified the Xboxes of 10 kids a year and they were all local college kids, or was this really having a large impact on the black market for these types of pirated games in the area? Do you guys know?
I don't know, but I can't imagine there's a huge business in modding Xboxes in person. It doesn't strike me as a big industry, but I mean, I may be wrong.
Yeah. He was running this out of his home. It wasn't like he had a warehouse where he had stocked up on, you know, Xboxes he was receiving from all over the country. As far as I know, at least. I mean, it was definitely run in his home, but I don't know how large it was. I mean, I think that was the other thing that some of the news stories focused on, is why are they singling out this guy? He was just sort of running this on the side. And I did see at least one article which said that this caused him to drop out of college, too, as he was, you know, concerned about the impending criminal charges and stuff, and the trial. It was at least a year or two lead time before they actually got him into court.
So I suppose part of this is irrelevant now, but there was that the judge had thrown out the argument that this was fair use under the DMCA, even though that iPhones were exempted from that. Like, so you can jailbreak an iPhone, right? So I was curious why there was that distinction. I mean, I see how, you know, the iPhone policy only applies to that which it says, but I mean, the iPhone is in some regards a gaming platform, and philosophically I don't see why, even if, you know, you don't consider the iPhone a gaming platform, why there would be that distinction between essentially jailbreaking one and not the other.
Well, actually, that's a really good question. So every 3 years or so, the U.S. Copyright Office convenes and they have an open call for suggestions on exemptions for the anti-circumvention provisions in the DMCA. And what they do is they welcome submissions for people to suggest reasons why certain activities should be excluded from being held civilly liable for copyright infringement or violating the anti-circumvention provision. But usually those are instances where fair use would most likely apply. And more specifically, those tend to be uses that are either very personal or it's being done for research purposes. Usually they're the types of uses where there is no commercial factor involved in it. Let me start here. The funky thing about the anti-circumvention provisions is it's not really clear if fair use actually applies to violations of it. There's a couple of funny provisions, the way that they're worded in the Act. It makes it unclear if the traditional excuse to copyright infringement, that is, fair use, could actually apply to a violation of the anti-circumvention section. And that's because fair use applies to copyright infringement, but the way that the anti-circumvention section is worded, it seems to suggest that you can have an additional violation of the Copyright Act that is not considered infringement, but still violates the law just by circumventing an access protection mechanism on a copyrighted work or an access control, something that prohibits the copying or access to a copyrighted work. But there is at least one court out there, a circuit court of appeals, and I actually want to say it's the Fifth Circuit, but I, going off of memory, and that might be incorrect, that said that you need to actually have an infringement of one of the exclusive rights, meaning that you had to copy it, you had to distribute it or create a derivative work in some way or publicly display it, etc., in order for it to actually be a violation. And the ones that have been accepted by the U.S. Copyright Office tend to be things that are almost purely fair uses. So if you're jailbreaking your iPhone, for instance, which is the one this year, I mean, we talked about this on a podcast several months ago when that came out. So I know that it seems probably funny that they don't have exceptions for this. I mean, it's always possible in the future that they could enact new exemptions for, you know, something like Xbox modifying or sort of like jailbreaking it. But since this ultimately relates back to another form of piracy, or at least it seemed to in this case, that the concern was black marketed games that you can buy on the street and run on a modified Xbox, that they probably wouldn't look at it in the same way that they would look at, and it's just like a personal thing, you know, jailbreaking an iPhone. So does anyone else have any other thoughts, or Lou, want to follow up on that?
I think that kind of makes sense. It seems unclear where that line of, you know, how illegal the activity is, you know, whether there had to be intent to use it for pirated games or whatnot, but I understand what you're saying.
The second half of this, and I could just hit this really quickly, is that he was doing this for commercial purposes. He was charging people to come into his homes and he would do the modification in front of them. This wasn't like he was doing this for his own uses, and if you look back to the fair use factors, one of them is sort of the impact on the market and another is sort of the nature of what you're doing. I mean, in a case where somebody is doing something for a commercial game, no one of these factors is dispositive by itself, but if you have commercial activity going on, it usually doesn't look very good. So it could weigh heavily if it's being done for the purpose of, you know, running pirated games on the machine itself. At least to me, it seemed like sort of a weak argument, the fair use argument, that is. Any other thoughts?
I'm all set.
All set.
All right, so our third story today is this little dispute between Level 3 and Comcast by way of Netflix. And so what happened was that Comcast, a content service provider, wanted to start charging Level 3 for essentially online video. And this is right after that Level 3 had signed a new contract to be a provider for Netflix, and Netflix obviously carries a lot of online video. It's right there in the name. So the reason Comcast was doing this is because A, during peak times like between 8 p.m. and 10 p.m., Netflix accounts for as much of 20% of traffic on some networks, which was a figure that I thought was rather astonishing. And then also, just that Comcast had charged the previous provider for Netflix this same fee. Look, we charged Akamai or something, is the previous company, so they should be able to charge Level 3 that same fee, and therefore they see that as equitable. However, Level 3 sees this a bit more of a violation of net neutrality, saying, look, you're charging us more for these bits than you are for these bits. That's not neutral. One thing that I think would help sort of illuminate this is just to explain where exactly all these parties sit, which is essentially that the internet is a series of tubes, but it's a hierarchical series of tubes. You, me, and most other consumers are sort of on this first level, and we connect to the internet through some service provider. So I'm connecting through Charter Cable and the guys in Boston through some other network. The reason we were able to connect is not only are we connected to the cable provider, but the cable providers are connected to each other through what's called the internet backbone. And so the cable providers are essentially Level 2 customers, and that makes the backbone providers, you guessed it, Level 3. And so some companies, go through the internet providers as well, but ones that have very high usage, they can deliver their content faster if they go directly to the third level. If they connect directly to the backbone and negotiate some sort of contract between them and the backbone provider, like the internet service providers have as well. And that's essentially what Netflix does, because it's obviously going a high traffic provider. And so that's really where this dispute happens. And one thing that people are troubled by is that, while this doesn't affect the consumers directly, if Level 3 ends up being charged more by Comcast, that's going to get it's going to hurt their Netflix's bottom line, because they'll have to pay more for Level 3 and so on. Level 3 ultimately did reluctantly sign the contract with Comcast to pay the fee, but basically under protest, and it is now under FCC investigation to sort of see whether or not this is a violation. Does that about cover all the facts here?
I think so.
So that's sort of the technical perspective of this. Do you guys see any validity to Comcast's argument of basically, well, we charged Akamai for this, we should be able to charge you for it?
Cue discussion of peering agreements.
Yeah, I think, as glib as that comment was, and in a lighthearted way, that's kind of the issue here. When we previously thought of net neutrality, it didn't really include peering agreements. We were talking about getting specific bits from one place to another. The way Comcast is framing this is that we're not discriminating against types of bits, we're discriminating against quantity of bits. The way Level 3 is framing the argument is saying they're not discriminating against quantity of bits, they're discriminating against the type of bits, because these bits are coming from Netflix, which leaves us here not knowing whether this is actually a net neutrality problem or whether it isn't. Because Comcast has a decent argument that, you know, with traditionally peering agreements were essentially we're going to allow these two parties to transfer traffic across our network, and we're going to try to balance it out so that they're sending the same amount of net traffic against across our network as we're sending across theirs, and if there are overages, we'll settle that based on money. Which, you know, if you're not really caring about where those bits are coming from, yeah, that seems, you know, decently fair. Level 3 is saying Comcast is giving us a harsh deal because we're carrying Netflix, and Netflix competes with Comcast. I mean, other than that, I really don't know what to say, because we're kind of stuck in this weird rubbery area between one party, you know, possibly legitimately claiming that it's not content-based discrimination, and the other party also possibly legitimately claiming that it is content-based discrimination. You know, where do you go from there other than say it's an impasse, and this is probably why there should be some government regulation in place, so at the very least we can define what the problem is.
This is a complex arrangement, I think, between all the various intermediaries on the actual the physical architecture of the network connections that represent the internet backbone. As you aptly described, David, the internet backbone is not owned by any one entity. It's owned by a series of entities that sort of all interconnect each other. And if you can imagine that from the point of your home getting to a particular web server, you know, you could cross across, you could cross several different ownership boundaries across the actual internet backbone. Although it happens very quickly, I mean, those boundaries are very real. And because of that, you know, you have the ISPs, which have a very strong grip on connections to the home. They sort of own the fiber or the, you know, the cable from the backbone itself, and then it's distributed it out to each of the, you know, people who pay for their services' homes. They have the access to the clientele that the web servers want to serve their content to. So that includes people like Netflix. And I think that because of that, I mean, that this sort of underlies the broader network neutrality argument that all these intermediaries at some point are going to start disagreeing about things. And groups like Comcast, and by the way, Comcast is attempting to acquire or be acquired by NBC, and they also have several similar services compared to those that Netflix offers. You're seeing some of these ISPs play many different roles. It's not just the role of a internet service provider, but they're also providing cable TV distribution to those homes as they are the internet distribution. And when you play these multiple roles, you know, there might be an instance where Comcast or another ISP might choose to discriminate about how it does these access connections. And I think the basics of it are there are a couple different ways to do these agreements, but they all are on the basis of some sort of contractual agreement, or that may or may not mean that there is an actual exchange of money involved. There are the peering agreements, as they've been termed, and I think that means that the networks like the Level 3 network and Comcast have basically agreed, like, okay, it's just as long as the traffic is fairly balanced between us, you know, we'll keep the bits flying back and forth, and we're not really going to charge any money for access. But there's also various types of transit agreements, which are on a per-bit basis or some sort of, you know, it's an amount of data as it crosses costs a certain amount of money. That might mean that, you know, more tubes are open, if you want to use the tubes analogy, than are closed, and it allows more to pass through, or it's metered in some way. And because these entities have sort of taken on dual roles, Comcast can then say, well, we're not going to let you access any of our any of the connected homes that are on our that are paying for our services unless you agree to the following agreement. And the terms also include, by the way, you paying us a lot of money because, by the way, your traffic is freaking huge. You're Netflix and you're serving content all the time because everyone wants to stream and no one wants to watch TV anymore. And it doesn't surprise me that people might think of this as sort of a bigger network neutrality problem. I don't really know what it is. I mean, obviously Comcast doesn't want to paint it as something really negative, like them violating on the basis of content. They want to say, hey, no, this is just a capacity problem. It's, you know, throughput. It has nothing to do with the actual source of the bits, and it doesn't matter what websites they're coming from. It's just this network produces a lot, so we need to account for that in a monetary way.
So there are two things that you touch on that I think are important points. Is one that, you know, a lot of these cable companies are or potentially have some sort of dual nature in this dispute, in that, you know, I mean, not only is Comcast looking to buy NBC Universal, but then you have, you know, Time Warner, which is, you know, makes movies, and Warner Brothers, and all sorts of things. That really entangles this conversation. And then just one thing that I thought was really interesting is you can actually go on Level 3's website and take a look at the extent to which their network covers. And it's pretty interesting to see all the different wires they have running around the country and across the Atlantic to Europe as well, basically to show that they do have a very large presence as part of the internet.
Also kind of goes without saying that I think more people these days are taking advantage of TV streaming over the internet, whether they're doing that from a place like Hulu or whether they're doing it from Netflix or other websites out there or services out there. I do think, though, that the overall trend is that there's an increase or an uptick in the amount of traffic from those types of sites. And that also goes without saying that YouTube, by the way, is hosting an incredible amount of video. I mean, I don't know that it's, I don't know what the significance is and how they have it distributed over their servers, but I would imagine that it's, you know, a lot of data that's also passing through. A lot of people use those services too.
As time goes on, the video is getting more and more high definition, higher resolution, and as such, even more bits are being transmitted as these TV shows are being watched. So, which is clogging the networks, and, you know, one of the stronger arguments the internet service providers have for wanting to regulate.
Right, and I did see also that the FCC is looking into this, and the story also popped up in a week where the FCC has released what they're calling new guidelines for network neutrality principles. We don't really have time to get into those, but the FCC, as we've seen in the last couple of years, has tangled before with Comcast, and they had a lot of problems doing that. Specifically, the court said, hey, by the way, you don't really have jurisdiction, you don't have the jurisdictional reach to enforce these types of network neutrality violations according to the FCC's regulations that they tried to promulgate. Now it looks like they're coming out with some new ones, but their guidelines and guidelines at the FCC are a little funky in that they don't really have the force of law. It's more guidelines for how they're going to currently enforce regulations that are already in place, and given the Comcast and the court case, I don't know how that's actually going to play out in this or if it even has any role in it, but the FCC does have pretty extensive regulations just over telecommunications infrastructure type stuff in general. There's a lot of old principles that go back, and I don't know that any of us here can really claim any expertise with them, but with like the telecommunications infrastructure and the common carrier type thinking about how people access the phone system, like back in the 70s and stuff.
All right. Any final thoughts, David O?
Interesting dispute. I'm a little bit surprised that it has gotten, or that this was, that this leaked out to the public in the first place. I mean, usually it if you're in negotiations with another company, the last thing you want is to have some public spat over the terms of the agreement. So I don't know if this means that the relationship has totally crumbled or if this just shows you the power leveraging that's going on behind the scenes with internet backbone issues.
Yeah, on that front, I think Level 3 intentionally leaked this as a way to try to get Comcast to bend out of fear of public outcry or government regulation. I don't know how well that worked.
If you guys were in charge, how would you resolve this?
In charge of the FCC, in charge of Comcast, in charge of Level 3.
In charge of the FCC.
I don't know. I mean, that's a heavy question just on the basis of all the problems that they've had regulating this type of stuff so far. And so forgetting about that for a moment, I mean, you do want to make sure that there is some notions of fairness in what Comcast is attempting to do here. And maybe they're not the bad actor. Maybe they're, you know, is a huge amount of traffic that is coming from Level 3 and that there's a real reason, real capacity reasons, you know, that it's burdening their network in some way that they really should be compensated for it. But I don't know how that plays into what Level 3 is saying, that it, you know, this sort of is going against the grain in terms of industry standard practices and stuff?
I think if it comes down to the initial dispute, which we said, which was but basically quantity versus quality, then you know, if it is a quality thing, i.e. what kind of bits they're sending over the packets, then I would say, yeah, that sounds like a violation of neutrality to me. But if it is just a quantity type of dispute, type of fee that level 3 is being charged, then that might be valid.
Yeah, the biggest problem to me is just the dual role that entities, that the ISPs are playing, you know, the actual entities that provide the access to the average internet user who's sitting in a residential home. I think that's what really complicates it, because then you could always paint this with the brush that, hey, look, this really has the appearance of impropriety.
Any final thoughts?
Also.
All right. Well, thank you again for joining us for this podcast. If you have any story suggestions or comments, please email them to podcast@technicallylegal.org or check us out on Twitter @TechLegal.
Signing off.
I'm Ben Snitkoff.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
I'm David
And I'm David O'Brien. Thanks for listening.